The Sunday Show with Ireland's Blue Book, a romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome to tonight's Sunday Show. I'm delighted now to be joined by Conor Power, who is an award-winning journalist, travel writer, ex-auctioneer, funeral director, and originally from County Waterford, living in Cork. Now, Conor, lovely. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. That's a lovely introduction too.
And of course, Conor, we're going to be chatting about your exciting, your first novel, which is going to be coming out shortly, called
Hurling 1810.
And now, I mean, for anybody, not alone a person like myself from Cork, right, who is obsessed with hurling, this is going to be an amazing read for anybody, because it's a gripping tale of hurling as it was played two centuries ago. We're going to talk a little bit about the history of hurling as well. But tell me, how did you get into travel writing? Because I know I've read some of your stuff. You have an amazing gift. And you have a lot of, you have loads of awards, of course, rightly so. But how did you fall into travel writing?
I came the circuitous route of auctioneering, actually, I suppose. Going back a bit further, I suppose I was an auctioneer kind of by accident, and ended up doing it for about 11 years, actually, in Bantry in West Cork. But during that time, I started getting an interest in writing. So I joined a writing group, which is, I think if anyone's interested in writing, that's the first place to start. So I started writing in my own time and gaining confidence by writing more and more. I was also writing a lot of nearly all the brochures for all the houses. I started putting together videos. I think we were the first in Ireland, as far as I know, to start using YouTube videos to promote properties. And I also started sending in copy to the newspaper to promote properties. And they would normally just take it and then just print it as is without even changing it. So I then graduated to writing about overseas property. And at that time, there was a big boom, the Celtic Tiger.
Is this what everybody had? I was like Sunny Beach.
That's exactly. Sunny Beach in Georgia, wherever it was. Everybody's remortgaging what they had to gain a property overseas. So it was huge, huge business. And there were huge supplements with every newspaper. I started writing about that. And then I remember I was getting, of course, you get into that and you get offered trips for people who are selling properties all over the world as well. And I remember one time I was offered another trip to Mexico and I couldn't go because I'd run out of holidays. And I thought, oh, I think I might try this full time.
The day job was getting in the way of the travel writing.
Yes, yeah, that was the problem. So I solved it by getting out of auctioneering and going into travel writing and writing about overseas property mainly full time. And that's really where it began.
Now, yeah. I remember you told me a very, very interesting story as well. You won a prize on a radio competition.
It was, yeah. It was on Today FM. And it was a prize that was very good for a bit of a linguist like myself, because you had to, I don't want to go into too much detail of it because it'll take all day to tell the whole story. But basically, I won a holiday in the Martinez Hotel in Cannes in the south of France. And when I went there, of course, it really opened my eyes to what a 5-star hotel looks like. I think it was my first time in one. And then when I came back home, then I noticed that the Sunday Tribune and other papers were doing these little features about 5-star hotels all over the world. So I proposed doing an article about this hotel I'd been to, and they said, oh, yes, we'll take that. I got back onto the hotel then, in the Hotel Martinez in Cannes, and asked for some photos to go with it. And I found that you know, all these hotels have got very good public relations teams who are very helpful towards journalists who want to write about their hotels. So from that, I kind of got into writing a lot about 5-star hotels for different papers and about general travel as well. I would kind of combine maybe family holidays with visits to here, there and everywhere. So
amazing. And I mean, the interesting thing about it, of course, is that it becomes a bug. I think the Greeks call it dromomania, what I think, the inability to sit still. But once you go down that path, Conor, it's hard. There's no going back, really.
No,
is there?
There's no going back. It's a rabbit hole, a very pleasant one. And you just end up, the opportunities as a journalist and travel writer are just seemingly endless, really. And it's very hard to stop doing that, you know.
Now, I know you're brilliant. You speak French. You've travelled extensively in France. The river cruising has become very popular, but some of your articles and stuff I've read, it's amazing some of the places that, I mean, wouldn't even know in France that you've been to.
I've travelled an awful lot in France. I went to college there, so I got to learn the language fluently, and I still keep it up with French friends and reading books and watching TV and so on. But even some of my French friends joke about, they ask me for advice when they're going to travel in France. So I've been to, except for the kind of eastern bit, I suppose, I've been to nearly every corner, I think, of the country. It's a huge country. I haven't really, but I've been to an awful lot of it, yeah.
Amazing. Now, I'd like to just, very interesting. I mean, the hurling, of course, is the best sport in the world, as we know, right? Without a doubt. Of course, you have hurling in your blood. Your father, Ned Power, was a famous hurler. Tell us a little bit about your dad.
Well, my dad was from a very completely non-sporting family in Dungarvan in County Waterford, and he famously won the All-Ireland, was on an All-Ireland senior Waterford winning team back in 1959. He's famous beyond that for a couple of things, I suppose. One is a very famous photograph of him catching the ball, leaping over the head of Christy Ring. If you know that photo, you'll find it all over the place. And secondly, it's from the semi-final of the Munster semi-final in 1962, in fact. And the second thing is that he also became a well-known coach. So he, first of all, I suppose, he was a school teacher in Tallow, County Waterford, where I grew up. And he, because he was teaching all the kids, he had them all trained in the skills. And he was a great believer in the skills. And he was part of the very first people who, in the GAA, who set about defining all the skills in hurling and writing them down, putting them in a book, essentially, for training people. And he was a great believer in skills rather than brawn. And he had everyone playing this kind of almost Barcelona-esque hurling at the time in Tallow. And they won everything at every level while he was coach there. But he became well known as a coach in various other parts of the country too. He was a well known guy, and I never kind of progressed my own hurling career beyond the age of 14 because I had bad eyesight. But he was always he's a very well known guy especially in County Waterford. And when he passed away in 2007, after that, my mother encouraged me to write a book about him. So I wrote a book about my dad, and which I launched in 2009. So that was my first book that I wrote.
Brilliant. And what was that called?
It's called My Father, A Hurling Revolutionary.
Wow. Nice. Yeah. I must get a copy of that.
Yes.
Brilliant. I mean, it's lovely. That is lovely because as a legacy, isn't it, to your dad?
Oh, it is. It's fantastic. And it was great doing it because while I was there, I was interviewing all of his old teammates and a lot of people who knew him. And so while I was doing him, he was kind of with me all the time, if you know what I mean. Like, it's a very strange thing, losing a father, and it's very hard to get your head around the whole thing. And, you know, while I was doing it, it was a very good way of maybe getting me to turn slowly but surely. It's almost like therapy, I think.
It's funny when you say Christy. I mean, I remember my mum bringing me to Christy Ring's removal. I mean, like of Cork, probably about in March 1979. It was an interesting year for me. I went to Christy Ring's removal and I met the Pope in Rome, right? On a school tour with Prez, right?
Doubly blessed.
But like, yeah, I mean, it was funny. But I mean, it was, to give you an idea, of course, I mean, they were gods, weren't they, those days? It was amazing.
Oh, they were, of course, yeah. And of course, you know, television didn't even come into till much later. You know, like in the early 60s, a lot of people, it was word of mouth. So you can imagine how people's performances would be painted in big, broad strokes. And
I mean, they played, yeah. I mean, sure, Christy Ring was playing. What age was he? He was in his 50s, was he?
Oh, he was. He was still playing, I think, into his 50s, yeah. As was my dad, actually. Yeah, he was still playing club hurling. Definitely into his 50s, I would say. And I've done no idea which age, but he was still playing until late into life.
The history of hurling is very interesting, right? You were telling me when we were chatting a few weeks ago, it started when Cú Chulainn, was it?
Well, exactly. It goes way back into prehistory. So when it started is anybody's guess, really. It's been around for a long time. It's an ancient game. And it's been played in various forms all through the centuries. But it was still being played as a team sport now and again through the 1600s. There are accounts of that, even playing inter-provincial games or inter-county games and clubs playing against one another. too, but it was really in kind of middle of the 18th century, kind of from the 1760s onwards, that that the landed gentry class began to take an interest in it. And it was the time when they were when it was Ireland was their playground in many ways, and they were, you know, they were Ireland was booming economically as well, and they were putting money into horse racing. Horse racing took off at that time, and hurling then became codified between different big houses. And they would even, it became even professional or semi-professional, and they would pay the best players to play for them.
Brilliant. So we're going to delve deeper into that now. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back right after this. And you're listening to tonight's Sunday Show, and I'm delighted to be joined by Conor Power, award-winning travel journalist and writing his first novel. Conor, this is really interesting, a gripping tale of hurling as it was played two centuries ago. What was the inspiration for the novel? And I mean, I looking at the synopsis of it, and I had no idea about half of this stuff.
Yeah, it's an era that's not written about. And in fact, there's pretty much no fiction about hurling full stop out there, you know, which is a strange thing because it's such a popular sport and such a part of our culture in Ireland. But the inspiration for this book, okay, goes back to when I wrote the book about my father, because in the wake of that, a lot of people kind of came out of the woodwork, if you like, and contacted me, people who'd known my dad and were very inspired by him. And one of these guys was a coach as well from Cork City, and he was staying down in West Cork where I live, in Durris. So he contacted me and we kind of met in the local pub, and he was telling me, amongst other things, about the era of professional hurling. And he even had these laminated sheets showing me the whole thing. And I was absolutely amazed by it because I'd heard something about it. All right, I knew I'd heard something about it, but I didn't really know the story. And this was, of course, the era when gambling got so serious over horse racing and over hurling matches that they had to lay down strict rules. So they... The rules varied from place to place, of course. It depended on, you know, these guys getting together and putting them down. But one of the strongholds was around the kind of Limerick, Carlow area. And the other thing he told me was that he said that Donal Lenehan was the manager of the Lions back in the early 2000s. I think they went to South Africa. But anyway, during that time, he used that same display that he was showing me, all about professional hurling era, to illustrate how there could be, and there probably are, connections between the game of hurling as it was played back then and rugby, because the layout of the team was exactly the same. They had forwards, the scrum, the big heavy guys, and then they had the guys in the middle, and then they had the guys at the back. And in many of the versions of hurling as it was played back then, it was the backs who got to do the kind of sexy work of scoring, while the fellas in the front could only hit the ball on the ground, and they were the big heavy guys who were trying to stop the opposition. And there was even a theory that William Webb Ellis, who invented rugby, might have witnessed this as a child in Ireland and then transposed the very same layout to rugby. So it's an idea, it's a theory. And apparently I was told, don't know if it's true or not, that Donal Lenehan used this then to help inspire his team coming from various parts of Ireland and Britain to show them that, look, you might think that the English invented rugby and the Irish invented hurling, but we're all far more connected than you think.
That's very interesting because, you know, I mean, Prez in Cork here used to play hurling. I remember when I went in there as a young fella, there was pictures on along the hallow halls and my grandfather would hurley, and I'm like, and then it became a rugby school.
Yes, there you are, you see.
It's funny, isn't it?
It is, and sure, rugby has become as Irish as anything at this point, so yeah. I just thought, what would it be like to have been a hurler plucked from obscurity and put on a team to play for this landlord? And maybe then, what if your father was a rebel and had been killed in 1798? You know, you would have very conflicted interests, but then you're getting paid for your play. And maybe you discover that these landlords aren't the monsters you thought they were. Maybe you fall in love with the landlord's daughter, who knows? So I think that got me thinking about the whole thing.
Amazing.
And that's where it came from. And I suppose I've been tinkering with this for the last 15 years, I think, and it's finally coming out.
But what's really lovely about it is, right, it gives a real kind of account of the deep political and social tensions, I suppose, at the time. It's not just, yeah. I mean, this is a complete picture of it's like a time capsule in a way, isn't it?
It is. No, it's a historical novel, which happens to have the background of hurling, and the main character is a hurler. But really, it's a snapshot, I think, of the era, and there when the more I was writing about it, and my publisher, Maurice Sweeney, who's a fantastic guy, but he got me to look a bit deeper into the historical era as well, because there was an awful lot going on, agrarian violence going on, for example, at the time. There used to be there was a split between Irish as well, you know, there were Shanavists and the Caravats, and the Shanavists and Caravats were split, I suppose, along the lines of a kind of an echo of the societal divisions pre-Cromwellian. So and they used to be killing each other as well. So
sounds sort of like an Irish version of Game of Thrones or something.
Well,
like,
yes, you know, Game of Thrones is very close to the bone, I think. And your
family, Saravat family, like, but it's just, yeah, wow, fascinating. Yeah. And where? I mean, those names. I mean, they're all obviously from somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, the Shanavests, I mean, obviously it comes from the old vests, yeah, or could be the old jackets as well, because vest is, you know, it's an old Latin word, and in French, the vest is a jacket. And the Caravats then were the dandy kind of working class types who used to wear cravats and top hats, and, you know, the kind of local gangsters who used to have several ladies in their harem, you know. This was the kind of people they were.
It's fascinating though, because it's so original. And again, I mean, we never heard any of this in school or anything.
No,
like that.
Nothing of the sort. You know, I was, you know, when I first heard of them, I doubted their existence myself. But no, there they were, and it kind of explains a lot too, in many ways, how maybe disunited the Irish were, and how, even though there was a great will to in 1798, that kind of period I'm talking about, and even help from the French, that they, you know, ended up kind of, it didn't really happen.
Yeah, and how long did it take? I mean, in terms of research, I mean, it was obviously a fairly long time, was it? Or
yeah, I couldn't really measure it in time accurately. I just, you know, because obviously as a journalist and working right, you're working on all kinds of several different things at once. And this was one thing that wasn't paying me to work on. So I was tipping away at it and writing bits and pieces and adding chapters, going back maybe over it and correcting things. Because with a historical novel, you really have to get the history right, or it kind of falls flat in its face. And I've introduced a few real life characters as well, you know, in it, one or two, to just help put a bit of context.
Yeah, because it reminded me a bit of like of George R. R. Martin, you know, the way he kind of did. He did. It's almost like a historic. You feel like it's real, of course, but it's nice because there's the reality, and there's a little bit of the fiction and the fantasy as well.
Yes, I mean, the fantasy doesn't extend to dragons, but it's still there is. Yes, it is. It's fiction. It's fiction essentially, which is rooted in a very real era of which very few people know about, and I think it'll I hope it'll be interesting anyway.
You must have been very excited when you started discovering all this stuff, because as I said, for me, even when you were telling me about it, I was very, very interested in talking to you about it, because again, it's revealing is the word I'd use.
It is, yes, absolutely. And, you know, and from the very time that I was told about the year of professional hurling and shown something, some images to kind of illustrate it, I was hooked. It was, it's unexpected. And it's, I think I love stories that delve back into the centuries, because, you know, you find that nothing has changed, but everything has changed. It's fantastic. You know, it's great to just get a window into that era. It's the same era as Jane Austen, of course, and this is Ireland and what was happening in Ireland at the time.
Mm. I feel a Netflix show coming on.
Yeah. You never know.
Charles Cavill, keeping the ancient game of hurling going. It's brilliant for Ireland, for the king, and the only way he can see preventing people tearing themselves apart. I love it. When is it? I know you can pre-order it now. When is it coming out?
It's coming out in early August. So provisionally, it's going to be the early August. It's going to be early August. I don't know the exact date, but if you keep an eye on Menma Books, you'll see when it's coming out. But provisionally, I think we're talking around the 7th of August, but thereabouts. I don't want to
Wonderful.
Be saying dates before.
Yeah, Hurling 1810. Now, I also want to chat to you about, you're an expert ghostwriter. I was going to say that's connected to your funeral director days, but that's just a fun. But ghostwriting is, I mean, not the easiest thing in the world to do, but you have found a niche there. You're very, very good at it.
I'm still doing it, and I'm working on a couple of books at the moment. It's fascinating because you get to delve into someone's life and you become part of their lives in many ways, you know. Sometimes you're even a therapist, I think, you know.
How did that come about for you?
I started advertising years ago, I think, on writing.ie platform, a website. And there was kind of, you know, just to see what would happen. And I think there was nothing for maybe a year. And then all of a sudden, it just happened. And now I think people find me just from searching anyway. And because I've had some articles written about me. It was one in the Irish Times, for example. But so people just kind of find me just by looking me up or just Googling, I think, nowadays. But that's how it started. There was kind of nothing for a long time. And all of a sudden, and then during lockdown as well, there was another surge I noticed as well. So it's quite sporadic. It comes and goes, but it's very interesting to work with it. And every single, like, I start the same way. I interview people and then I say, I'll come back and write the first 20,000 words and see how you like that. Is that correct? That's how I normally work, you know. If so, they'll say, yes, carry on. And if not, I'll make the necessary amendments. But as soon as I started, it changes with every single person. It depends on the people, and the process seems to change every time. I think, you know, it's very unique.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, and to get the correct, I suppose, for you, there's a formula, I suppose, in how to get the information that you need in a way that you can make it, you know.
Yes, exactly. And it's getting the voice is the big thing too. You know, once you get the voice right of the person, and then they're happy, you know, this is what I want to say and this is how I want to say it, really, is what it's about. And then after that, the service is one of organizing, really, you know, because nobody can sit down and tell their life story, and most of these are biographies. So the process is different from person to person. And
so if I want to write some of my amazing books that are in my head, right, I think the challenge would be, how would I get them out them into your head?
Well, exactly. Getting them into my head, first of all, and also getting things in the right order that's going to make sense, maybe chronologically, or it could start at a very significant event in their lives, for example, and then it goes back from there. It depends.
So you know how to bring structure to it, of course. That's part of the talent,
yes, exactly,
of ghostwriting, isn't it?
It
to
is.
Give
it
structure.
Yeah.
You're like AI in a way.
Yes, exactly. The dirty word. But anyway, yes, you bring structure to it. And of course, as I was saying, like, nobody can start at the very beginning themselves and tell everything in a chronological order. So you find you're putting things in like a jigsaw puzzle, and you go back and you say, well, listen, what about that period you were telling me about? And you go back to it, and maybe you're filling in bits of the jigsaw. You're putting the edges all around, first of all, and you're finding all the little kind of interesting bits and put them in, and gradually you fill in the whole thing. At least that's in theory, at least. That's how you do it.
We'll have to have a chat after the program. Okay, Conor, we're just going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we're going to be traveling to Antarctica. And you're very welcome back to the Sunday show. Conor, I guess Antarctica is probably every travel writer's dream of a destination, is it? And I'm very jealous.
I guess it is. And I have to admit that when it was offered to me, first of all, my first thought was white, boring, possibly, but I can't say no to this, that's for sure.
Take us through, I mean, how did you get there? You know, what did you do when you were there? I know it's polar bear free down there. So you weren't in danger anyway.
No, you are in danger for some things. But unless you fall into the water, you should be grand. Mm. So getting there, first of all, the nearest point is the best place. So the nearest point is at the tip, beyond the tip of South America, sorry. So what we did was, I travelled via Paris to Buenos Aires, and then took another flight from Buenos Aires down to the very tip of Argentina, which is a place called Ushuaia, which is a very interesting kind of frontier town on the very tip there in Patagonia, where the mountains are just towering. You're at the tail end of the Andes. It's fairly spectacular. So from Ushuaia then, there are a lot of trips going from there, and you have roughly 1,000 or so kilometers to go by the Cape Horn, which is, and you're going by Drake Passage, which is a notoriously rough part of the world.
I saw a documentary about the ships that got lost there, and it's fascinating. It's a part of the world that is the dangerous part, isn't it? That Drake's Passage was notorious for like coffins and ships being lost.
Oh, it is, yes. And it's apparently it's really rough, you know. So if you're one in every, one 50 or something is very smooth, if you're very lucky. And we had one of those, which was incredible. In fact, we had our expedition leader, because on these cruise ships, you have an expedition leader, you know, it's not it's not exactly all fun and games. It's very interesting. So you have lectures about all sorts of stuff, you know, to do with the trip, and which makes it really brilliant, I think, you know, because it's still, you still have the luxury, you still have the kind of bar and the nice food and everything else. But all the kind of expedition leaders and the people involved, they're all experts in some part of it, whether it's birds or whether it's there are even sometimes, you know, scientists who are on, who are doing this as part of their studies on penguins or God knows what, you know. But it's fascinating.
I took Brittany Ferries to Bilbao and there was a marine biologist telling us all about the dolphins and the whales, which we didn't see.
That's a great trip.
You're in another level here, of course, but that was amazing. So you have how many people are on the expedition, because they're icebreakers, some of those ships, aren't they?
They're designed to, they're not icebreakers now, you know, that's a different kettle of fish altogether. But they are sort of ice-friendly ships,
Yeah,
so they can get through, you know, a lot of ice fields, and you come across quite a lot of them. And, I mean, on our way down, first of all, I didn't expect it to be so smooth. And our expedition leader, a guy from South Africa, was saying that in the 300 crossings he's done, it was the most consistently smooth one he's done. He said he wasn't a smoother one once, but then it turned nasty halfway through. But this was like, it was more like a ferry from France to Ireland, honestly, on the way down. On the way back now, it was a little bit rough, all right. But I was expecting little enough going down there, because I'd never been there, obviously. And when you go to Antarctica, you think, well, you read a lot of headlines about global warming and about big chunks of ice breaking off. And so I thought, first of all, it might be just grey. Like, this is the middle of summer, so there might be no snow. Also, on the way down, there was mist all the way down. I couldn't see a thing for maybe halfway down. So I thought, we're going, you know, we might see nothing. But that morning at 6 a.m., I think we arrived into this bay, Fournier Bay it was called, in fact, named after some of the first French explorers. And it was beautiful morning. The sea was calm. It was like a lake. Everywhere was snowy, pristine. Every valley you saw was a glacier. The thick snow all over the place. In the water, there were whales jumping through it. There were all these things. And myself and this other Scottish colleague of mine were looking down from the top with our mouths open and tears in our eyes. And there were these little things. I said, what the hell are those jumping fish? You know, and he said, I don't know. That's a good Scottish accent.
Very good. Were they flying fish?
Well, that's what we thought. And then we got the binoculars out, and they were penguins, of course. Like, you know, when you don't see them in the wild, and you see them in the zoos, the only place I've seen them before, we've seen them in the wild, they just go zooming through as fast as they can to get away from predators, and they're looking for fish themselves. And of course, they're small enough, of course. You think of penguin, you might think of it as, you know, man-sized kind of yolk, but of course, most of them are very small. So it is absolutely breathtaking. One of the most beautiful places I've been.
And how long did you spend there?
We were there about 9 days altogether.
Wow. You just travel along to different places?
Yes, that's it. And I mean, they aim to have two landings a day as well. So that's really good. And the landing, you know, you're taken through what you must do for a landing. They're very careful and fastidious about making sure you're not going to contaminate Antarctica and you're not going to bring anything back from Antarctica onto the ship. So, you know, you bring all your clothing and your woolly hat and your whatever you're going to bring with you. And they go through that and they make sure there's no things in it, seeds or anything like that. And they hoover everything carefully, you know. And then you go through a kind of a sheep dip as well, as you get off the boat onto the Zodiac, and you go off, you come out this kind of hole in the side of the ship, if you like, onto the Zodiac, and you're brought ashore like that. And you kind of, they give you these special rubber boots as well to make sure you don't get wet, you know, because you have to kind of splash through the water a little bit to get ashore, you know, because this is wild. I mean, it's just vast wilderness.
And I'm thinking of a David Attenborough doc, you know, one of David Attenborough's gorgeous natural history programs or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the way you're just taking us through there. What was the highlight for you? I mean, there was many, I'd say.
There were many, yes. But the highlight for me was one evening, probably on the second night, we had to actually cancel our original plan, because where we were meant to go through was supposed to be this gorgeous place at sunset, where you go through this between two high mountains. But there was too much ice in the way, so we couldn't do it. So we had to kind of stop and wait in another bay. But what happened then was all these humpback whales began feeding, and there was about 20 of them, I'd say, altogether. And they were doing this bubble net fishing, as you see on the Dave
Attenborough
documentaries.
It, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, to corral the fish into a tight ball.
And then flying upwards and catching them with their mouths. And that just went on and on in different groups, you know. It was like fireworks, and it went on for so long. I was actually not getting bored of it, but getting tired, because you have midnight. You don't have quite. We weren't quite over the Antarctic Circle, but we did have a midnight sun. You know, like the sun didn't really go down. It was just bright the whole time. So it was like a 11:30 at night. Eventually, I just had to go to bed. You know, but it was going on and on.
I've had some wonderful travels up in Finland, up in the Arctic Circle, there, and. Media, I mean, they all go mad, but it's a blackout curtains and everything, but it's incredible, isn't it? There is no night, really.
It is, and it's a strange thing. It's a very, very strange feeling not to have any night, and it just, I don't know, it's hard to describe. It's a weird thing. It's a very weird thing.
And, of course, I mean, they're quite luxurious. I mean, you were on you with? Was it one of the cruise companies, I presume, one of the expedition?
Yes, it was Swan Hellenic. Yeah.
Okay, and, so they'd be known, I suppose, for their very strong sustainability. And as you were said there, they have experts who kind of, you know, you're entertained basically for the whole 9 days, aren't you?
Oh, you are, yeah, because every lecture is really interesting. Interesting. I mean, there was one guy there, he was a Danish guy, but his grandfather was a great explorer back in the, you know, back in the...
Amundsen.
Yeah, he wasn't Amundsen now, but he was an Amundsen-esque type of guy. Yeah. And this guy was great, you know, a multilingual guy, he knew everything about birds.
And did you feel, I mean, we see, as you said there, we see, of course, with the global warming, you see the big, huge chunk. Did you feel that, you know, how did you feel when you were there?
I felt... Like I'm no expert. I saw no evidence of global warming that I could see. But again, I'm no expert now. I don't want to be trying to say there is no global warming, but because there is. But I was surprised by that, because we're in the middle. That was in December, and that's the middle of their summer. So I was expecting it to just very little ice. Because when you see it on a map, that bit that comes that looks like it's touching South America almost of Antarctica, that's where we were. So I thought that would be the warmest, greenest part of Antarctica, but no, it was just magnificent. All the creatures you see as well, besides the humpback whales, you know, like the birds they have there, fantastic. It's all fantastic.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, I must say it is, I mean, it's on my list at some stage to do it, but it's actually not that difficult. I mean, nowadays it's not that, I mean, years ago you'd like inaccessible, but of course now it's not difficult. It's just have to have a few bob.
You do, yes. I mean, like that trip is around €10,000 a head. Mm. Even, you know, that's from Buenos Aires, right? So you got to get there first. And there are all kinds of more luxurious trips. You can even fly to Antarctica from South Africa now. And there were quite a lot of ships in the area. If you look up on the kind of, you know, the internet, and you can see, find a ship finder and see the other ships. There could have been 5 or 6 in our area, I would say, but you rarely see them. It's just so huge. It swallows up. You know, Antarctica is bigger than Europe. It's absolutely massive, and it's...
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at some of your photos, and it's incredible stuff.
It is. I mean, such a vast, quiet place. Like, the only kind of time we came across other human beings who were on land was in this place called Port Lockroy, where they used to have stations that were for kind of spying and military and all that kind of thing. But now it's just kind of people who are doing studies there of some sort, and they get to stay there. 5 of them living in this, one of those Nissen huts. And it's for tourists. So people come there and they visit this place in Port Lockroy, buy a sweatshirt if they want. And the whole place is all surrounded by penguins, of course, and you must give penguins right of way. But the penguins, you can just look laughing at them, observing them all day. They're really brilliant. But in Port Lockroy, you can also send a postcard as well.
So I'm sure you would recommend, so it's bucket list stuff, of course. And I suppose a lot of people on the, it's like something that they wanted to do, and it's a real... Yes. Bucket list job, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yes. And it's an extraordinary thing to say you've been there and to see it with your own eyes. It's because there's nothing else to compare it. I've seen, you know, I've been to Alaska as well, you know, and that's a fantastic wilderness, but there's nothing, it doesn't compare with this. And just in terms of the vast white that's there. And we even got to do a plunge as well, an Antarctic plunge. So I couldn't say no to that. So I dived in as well.
Wow, yeah. Incredible.
Yeah, from the ship, you know, they put a harness on you to pull you out just in case. But I mean, I've been in cold water before. Like I do, you know, sometimes swim in the winter, even at home. And when it's at its coldest, you know, you'll start to kind of freeze up after a minute or two. But there you freeze up instantly. And you find, like, I wasn't sure if I'd make it back to the ship. That it's that cold.
Your Wim Hof moment.
Yeah. There was one guy there, a Russian guy doing Wim Hof. He's going in twice, actually. He seemed to be grand, but no, that was really cool. But I'm glad I did it. Really fantastic.
Amazing. I mean, it's hard to beat that, really, isn't it? I mean, have you any exciting travels planned?
Well, funnily enough, I'm going
to the Beira Peninsula.
Well, that's fantastic too. Funnily enough, I'm going to up beyond the Arctic Circle next week.
Go away.
Tell us,
where you go. I mean, obviously, that's which country you're going up into?
In Norway, I'm going to, and I'm starting in Bergen, and it'll be a 2-week cruise with Hurtigruten, and we're going all the way up actually to the Svalbard, the islands, which are way, way above Norway. In fact, I have a globe at home, and Svalbard is so far north, it's under the kind of cap at the top of the globe, you know? It's way up.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I've read about polar bears up there as well, of course.
Yes, they're polar bears. Yeah,
yeah, and they came, I mean, I know it's supposed to be talk with global warming, with the ice melting, they're going to places that they didn't go before, I suppose.
Polar bears.
But Norway, that's very interesting, because I saw the Northern Lights up in Tromsø there.
Oh, very nice.
And nothing as exciting as your adventures now, but the Northern Lights weren't bad, I must say. Northern Finland as well. Of course, voted the happiest country in the world this year again, Finland. There must be something with the snow.
Yeah, I have my doubts about that. But anyway, I'll have to go and inspect them to see how happy they are.
Well, listen, sometime. That sounds brilliant. Anyway, so you're going to be heading up there for how long? For two. And Hurtigruten, of course, they were working ships, weren't they?
They were, and they still are, apparently. They still stop, they stop along the way, and they'll be picking up school kids and people just travelling, just all getting from A to B. They were set up for that, really, just to be... Just a means of communication for the people.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah. Well, listen, intrepid traveller and explorer Conor Power, and very exciting with the new novel as well, Hurling, yes. 1810. It's been a pleasure to chat to you this evening, and thanks for taking us on these lovely journeys.
Thank you very much.
Well, folks, that's just about it for me for this evening. A big thanks to my guest, journalist and travel writer Conor Power. I can't wait to dive into his new novel, Hurling 1810. I have a feeling it's going to be a big hit, especially with GAA and hurling fans across the country. And wasn't it fascinating hearing about Conor's terribly boring trip to Antarctica? Honestly, the man never stops. As we speak, he's now wandered off to the other end of the planet, the Arctic Circle. I think we'd have to crown him the Expedition Prince of Ireland. Anyway, we'll definitely have to get him back on the show to hear all about life up there in Svalbard, polar bear country. Stay safe up there, Conor, and try not to look too tasty. Next up, it's one of my absolute favourites here on Sunshine, a Sunshine Swing with the legend himself, Tom Cole Jr. I'll be back at the same time next Sunday with more chat stories and a bit of music. So until then, have a great week, look after yourselves, and as always, Wake Us Live Galair.